We're happy to have Itai tell us about something today. Itai has been visiting us for more than 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and he's still here for a few more days. So today Itai will be telling us about a project that has been going on since 21 something something. When I first heard about this from Diego. And it will be about many charged particles in our galaxies, solar systems, and direct detection.
So yeah, I already said this before the recording, but now that we're recording, I want to emphasize again, this talk is very informal. If things are not clear, feel free to ask me. We're going to have like 6 different topics, and they are mostly independent. So if you lost me at one thing and you're too lazy to ask about that one, you can come back, drop back in and listen to the next one. This work is definitely in progress, so a lot of the preliminary results are very, very preliminary. Yeah, there's a bunch of collaborators here. We have Jae-Yok Chang, Ruben Essig, Nadav Mosgin, Diego Redicola, and Tomer Volansky. And I'm Itai, you may have guessed. And let's start with the outlines. I'm going to give you some basics of mini-charged dark matter and some of the rules of the game that we're going to play here. I'm going to tell you about some of the things that change how mini-charged dark matter propagates in the galaxy, galactic magnetic fields, cosmic ray acceleration, and supernova remnant acceleration. Then I'll tell you about mini-charged relics around us, specifically how the solar wind, Earth's magnetic field, and the overburden of the Earth's crust affects the distribution of mini-charged dark matter. And I'm going to tell you some preliminary estimates and I think how this work can be improved, because as you will see, there's a lot of systematic uncertainties. We try to control them by playing with some model variables. But in the end, I think this is a work that, you know, is supposed to be the first of building up towards more and more accurate simulations of what mini-charged dark matter would look like. So mini-charged dark matter is some relic. I will not actually assume for sure that it's 100% of the dark matter, because often we look at stuff that's like 10 to the minus 4 of the density of the dark matter that we have. And it is charged under some dark U1. Through kinetic mixing of the dark photon with our own photon, the mini-charged dark matter acquires an effective charge, Q effective, that we call capital Q, and it's proportional to this kinetic mixing. And in this work, basically the dark photon is not really going to play any part. We are assuming that it's light enough so that we don't need to worry about finite interaction length. However, if it's actually zero mass, then you can just decouple the mini-charged dark matter. You can rotate things away so that there's no actual effect. So basically, the assumption is it's light enough so we don't care about it, but it's not actually massless. And the reason why we say that it's a relic and not necessarily all of dark matter is just that if you have 100% of the dark matter being mini-charged, there are quite strong CMB constraints on the charge. And that's why usually if you take this mini-charged only this fraction, then what you find out is that you can hide the mini-charged dark matter inside the baryon density, because we don't know it, you know, to infinite precision. And that's why these bounds disappear around that small fraction. And last but not least, as a practical matter, the masses that I will be looking at are between an MeV and a TeV. The reason for the lower bound is just because things get a lot more complicated if you have something that's lighter than the electron. We're using a lot of things that rely on standard model computations, and people have thought about ions that are much heavier than the electrons, you know, muons, whatever, that are between electrons and protons, but no one really cares about stuff that's lighter than the electron, and things start to change if you can interact with electrons and your mass is lower. So that's why we put this lower bound. It's just for the sake of making the computation easier, and the bounds for lower masses is also much stronger. And the reason why we go up to a TeV, and this is a rough estimate, is just because this is when direct detection constraints start to disappear, because you just get too high a mass, even for charge one. The mass is very high, so even for charge one, the cross sections are very small. So it's just a matter of direct detection experiments being less important, and we're focusing on how mini-charged dark matter should look like for direct detection. So, after I gave you this, we're going to start to discuss what happens to mini-charged dark matter. Because naively, when we think dark matter in the galaxy, we think, oh, it should be distributed according to Maxwell-Boltzmann. But mini-charged dark matter has a lot of interactions with the standard model, and especially magnetic fields, that make it so that we would not actually expect it to have a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution necessarily. So you may have heard of the Lorentz force. It's pretty famous. And it just tells you how, if you have a momentum, you have a charge, how you're going to move in the presence of a background magnetic field. And you can rewrite this in terms of, instead of the derivative according to time, you can write it in terms of the slope. OK, so you just write dt over v. You write s hat, v hat, whatever. And what you end up finding is that the important thing here is something called the rigidity, which is just the ratio between the momentum and the charge. And this is what basically determines the slope for a given magnetic field. And the reason why this is important is that we have cosmic rays that have a high momentum. And if you have something that mostly cares about rigidity, a high momentum cosmic ray kind of looks like a small momentum millicharged dark matter with a small charge, right? They would have the same rigidity. And therefore, under a constant magnetic field, they would behave the same. As you will see, a lot of the things I'm going to show you only have to leading order, depend only on the rigidity. But once you enter other things can enter, especially if your magnetic field is sourced by a moving particle. Okay, so suddenly your velocity can also enter things. So there's a lot of complications, but the rigidity is an important thing that can tell us a lot by observing cosmic rays and then inferring things on millicharged dark matter. The other important thing, which is basically just going one step further in this simplification, is the gyro radius. If you have a constant magnetic field, the curve that you're going to move under is just a circle. Okay, and that circle has a radius, gamma mv over qeb. That's called the gyro radius. I think people sometimes call it also the Lamo radius. Well, I don't think I know. People also call this the Lamo radius. And just to give you some numbers, if you have 10 to the 9 gigavolts, because right, you need to divide by the charge, so we measure rigidity by volts, and you have a 1 microgauss field, you're going to get 1 kiloparsec of gyro radius. Now, why is this important? I want to tell you a bit about our galaxy. You may have seen it, but this is our simplified image of the galaxy, which, as you can see, is very, very simplified. First, we have a giant halo. In this halo, you have dark matter, but there's no magnetic fields, okay? There's no standard model particles. It's just a halo of dark matter. Now, inside this halo, we have what we call the magnetic box. In this magnetic box is where we assume the standard model magnetic fields are going to be present. They are roughly 1 microgauss in magnitude, maybe 10 microgauss or so. Okay, and there's a huge uncertainty on this HB, which is the size of this magnetic box, because it's not actually a constant magnetic field, and we kind of model it as constant. It can be anywhere from 1 kiloparsec to 8 kiloparsec, because again, you know, it's some long decaying thing. And inside this magnetic box, we're going to have both cosmic rays, okay, because they are also in this thing, and we're not going to have like stars and stuff. And we also have the magnetic fields, and inside this we have a tiny disk. As you can see, by calling this a box, we're going to look at 1D objects. And all of our master equations are going to look at 1D objects. And the reason is very simple. 3D simulations are a lot more difficult. And we have vague results that tell us that it's kind of OK up to orders of magnitude. And I think one of the, I will also mention this in one of the easiest way to make these computations more robust is to go to 3D simulations. So.
One question.
Yeah.
So for our halo, you know, presumably the millicharged dark matter itself will generate some B field. Is the size expected to be something like a Biermann battery kind of size, or
going to be expected to be what? Sorry.
Is the magnitude of that
so
expected to be something like a Biermann battery kind of magnitude, or
so because we kind of ignore the cosmic rays. The dark photon. My bad. You're not really going to see the millicharged dark matter creating an effect that interacts with the other millicharged dark matter. In the end, I will also mention this in the end, but I agree, the millicharged dark matter itself could have effects also not just in the halo, but also just in the disk moving around, and it could self-interact, and that could do things. However, in the halo, the reason why it's even is less important is because we're not actually going to do anything in the halo. The halo is going to be some thermal bath for us that provides particles. But you're right that in theory, there should be some magnetic fields, it would almost certainly, I think, be incoherent magnetic field, and you should not have, I think, a coherent component. And that can do some things, just because if your particles are moving, you know, in all random directions and they are not sorted according to charge, the positive and negative charges would cancel each other's magnetic field. But you would still get some incoherent, you know, magnetic field just from the fact that it's some statistical cancellation.
If the halo is rotating, that would give you.
No, you're right, but still, if you have positive and negative charges in the same quantity, for each particle moving that way, right, you have a particle with the opposite charge moving in the same direction. Therefore, the absolute magnitude should cancel, I think. But maybe there are second order effects that would make this appear. Again, I don't. We're not doing that. We're not simulating this. But I don't have a way to promise you that it's not some also important thing. Usually, we do. Because the halo is much bigger, you can try to tune it away with like the dark photon mass, but I think that's a bad way to look at things. Like to make it so that it's, you know, smaller than the total halo, but on the size of these things. But I think that's a bad way to do physics because it's really tuning. But yeah, you might be right. I think there's not just because of this cancellation, but still the incoherent magnetic fields are going to play an important part soon. So there's no reason to think they should not play an important part in the halo as well. So. Mini-charge dark matter evacuation. So this is something that I think in the 70s people were thinking about, but I might be wrong about the years because I don't know that actually people looked at mini-charge things at the time, but it's been long for a very long time. If you only have the coherent magnetic field, then, oh, by the way, as this is, again, an inform attack, I provide citations when I steal equations and pictures from people, but otherwise I will not actually provide the... with the full citations of people, so apologies in advance. It would have just informal talk. So if we have processes that remove mini-charged dark matter particles from the disk, okay, and as you will see, we do have some processes like that, and we only have a constant magnetic field, once you leave the galactic disk, if your rigidity is bigger than this, you simply cannot come back. The reason is, again, under a constant magnetic field, you move according to your gyro radius, and if your gyro radius is smaller than the size of the magnetic box, then you're just going to start to come inside the magnetic box, and then you're going to get deflected. So if the galactic disk, okay, is moving particles from itself, these particles will not be able to come back if you only have a constant magnetic field. Now, the thing is, if there are inhomogeneities on the magnetic of the magnetic field on scales that are smaller than the gyro radius, then by the time you start to moving around in a circle, suddenly the magnetic field is different. And now you're going to move around a different circle, and then it's different again, and you're going to basically just diffuse. So the galactic magnetic fields indeed have both a coherent and incoherent component, and both are roughly of the scale of micrograph, sorry. So a coherent guy would make you want to start to come in, and then you get deflected, while an incoherent guy will make you start to come in, and then you change your radius, so you're going to move around some other random circle, and then you move around, and in the end, you're going to just diffuse. So coherence causes deflection, incoherence causes diffusion. And we're going to start to build our master equation for the mini-charged dark matter in the galaxy, and this is the first term that we have. Because indeed, the magnetic field has incoherences on scales smaller than the gyro radius, this is kind of a charge-dependent question, but, you know, we put that into our calculation. You're going to get diffusion, okay, that depends on the charge according to, again, this incoherent magnetic field, okay? So this is the first part of our equation, and now we're going to start to add more and more things to it.
Can I ask you something?
Of course.
Depend on the past history of the magnetic field, do we know?
So the magnetic field, we have some models that they have some systematics. I don't know the actual source. I think some of them are phenomenologically fitted, but I think they do know the sources. Maybe someone here knows better.
I think we think the magnetic field is continually generated by a dynamo. What seeded the dynamo is, but you have, you know, magnetic fields constantly generated by the rotation.
I see, but if the galaxy was formed like out of more little things, where was there magnetic fields in those little things?
I think that's still.
I think this will be.
You would think would also occur in a, you know,
in smaller objects. Yeah, so you could build things up hierarchically. Sure. But whether, you know, early AGN were, you know, whether it was star, you know, early star from starbursts. Magnetic field.
So these you can kind of simulate. I don't think these are good approximations. As I mentioned, there's like a bigger code that I know astrophysicists use called Galprop that is supposedly simulates these things better than we do. But you can simulate like the scale, the typical scale between these incoherences due to supernovae bursts. I forget the name of the model. Kolmogorov is how we call the spectrum, but there's a name for this modeling, I don't remember. Whatever, the scale of these incoherences. But in the end, you don't strongly depend on the distant past, okay? Because what we mostly care about is things that, you know, on the scale of how long it takes you to go back to the disk. So as long as you're, you know, within kiloparsec per over virial velocity, roughly, I think that's going to give you the time scale of when things are mostly important to you. But in general, the magnetic fields are going to be minor effects compared to other worse things that we're going to have here. So I don't deny this whole project is mostly us saying, like, there's a giant systematic here. We play with our parameters of the model to try to simulate it. But in the end, more complicated, you know, simulations are required to get a robust thing here. However, right now, many people just, you know, use Maxwell-Boltzmann basically on Earth, which is orders of magnitude worse than what we do here. So I think galactic history is probably important, but again, not, you know, you don't need to know what happened right at the beginning, okay?
But like, for instance, if you had like smaller galaxies that formed then your galaxy, and then in those smaller galaxies the dark matter was already ejected or something because they had their own magnetic fields, which
but we only care about our galaxy.
No, but our galaxy forms out of smaller things, right?
But I'm saying, so I'm just confused. Your problem is things that happen inside the Milky Way.
So the Milky Way forms from smaller to smaller things. Those smaller things presumably also had magnetic fields.
But when did that happen?
I mean, the structures of the size of the Milky Way galaxy happened, like, Milky Way turnaround was at, like, redshift 1 or 2 or something like that. Turnaround of Milky Way was 2, redshift 2. Right?
So, like, 5 billion years ago?
Yeah, like
5 billion years ago-ish?
Redshift 2 was about 10 billion years ago.
10 million years ago? So, yeah, billion, yeah.
Billion.
Yeah. So, yeah, so again, so these things I think would get washed out by now. Just because you do a lot of rotations around the disk, right, for stuff in the disk, you do a lot of movements into the galactic disk from the outside by that time. So these things will probably be washed out. But I have not estimated this specific thing, yeah, so I cannot promise you.
And for the coherent field instead you model, we know that it's mostly oriented orthogonally to the plane of the disk.
Yeah, so it's mostly there. There's corrections, which are the X. I know the current thing, best thing is the RAR, GF914 or something model, which has like an X component. But in the end, you get a pretty big order one, two microgauss component in this direction. And that's what we use for the simulations. And again, I will mention this in the final slide. I think one of the easiest way to improve this whole calculation, is to include something like the Galprop, the Galprop code and modify it, because that one has, I think, a better treatment of the magnetic field. But also, in the end, magnetic fields are not that major of an effect because this diffusion is more important than the coherent factor. So there are some places where it's not true. OK, it depends on the exact charge and mass. But in the end, once you diffuse, you're going to get a factor of two difference in your Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. We're going to look at things that, you know, reduce your spectrum by 10 orders of magnitude in some cases. So these factors of two, I'm a lot less worried about. So the galactic magnetic fields are a thing that started our equations, but now we can also discuss what also modifies the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution in our galaxy. And one thing that some people here know better than me is cosmic ray collisions. So if you have cosmic rays in the galaxy, and he has a paper on it, that's why. So there are cosmic rays in our galaxy. They can collide, you know, with dark matter elastically, okay? And then you just get an accelerated diffraction of the dark matter, okay? You can just compute the cross sections. It's not, and you can compute how fast this thing occurs. And to describe that, we're going to split our velocity distribution discussion to low and high momentum, which are also called slow and fast guys. So the low momentum particles, if you scatter with a cosmic ray, you're going to disappear from the spectrum because you're no longer a slow person, right? Once you've scattered with a cosmic ray, you're now a very fast person. So you have some rate of making these guys disappear. If you, in theory, if you waited TCR and you had no sources from the outside, all of the slow guys would disappear because they collided with cosmic rays. For fast particles distribution, for the distribution for anything p bigger than some value, whenever a slow particle scatters with a cosmic ray, you're going to see that a fast particle appeared suddenly. So the probability for this to happen, okay, at any given space, and L is just the integral over all momenta here, Okay, we don't really care if you had exactly zero momentum or 10 to the minus 3 velocity, because in the end, your momentum is much, much smaller than the momentum of the cosmic ray. So these are small corrections. So it's just the number density at the given time and point in space divided by, again, the same rate, the rate of acceleration, times the spectrum of this process. Okay, so this process has a specific spectrum as a function of the momentum. And you just plug that in here, and this is the effect of cosmic ray acceleration. The next sort of acceleration that we have is a lot more complex. Yes, sorry.
Well, as you collide with something fast, like, do you collide with something slow and then like slow down? Like, as
you I'm going to enter that component in the end. This is the energy loss. Basically, if you have fast particles and they are moving through the ISM, they're going to lose energy due to a bunch of different processes. And I'm going to briefly mention that. But that process ends up being a lot less important. Okay. And in theory, you know, you can also ask, once you've been excited, you can also be, you know, collide again with a fast guy, whatever. But in the end, these processes end up being secondary. But the energy loss we do enter into our simulations, it just ends up being not that critical.
For cosmic rays, you know, similarly, they don't also cool down over time. That was my vague impression, that they get cooled dynamically. But
cosmic rays themselves, you mean?
Yeah, like...
I think... Even if they do, at a given time, we know the spectrum of cosmic rays, right, roughly?
No, sure, right. You know, but the same process cooling them down, I mean, presumably...
Oh, but the cosmic rays have a much higher charge. So any process that happens to them is going to be a lot, going to affect them a lot stronger, right? Because all these things are proportional to the charge or charge squared. So if your charge is like 10 to the minus 3, okay, you're going to be a lot less affected by these cooling processes.
Just the rigidity that matters.
So you can compute the rigidity that you end up having, and it's going to be the rigidity that matters. But it's not just the rigidity that matters. So the rigidity, I think, for this specific question, the rigidity, I think, does give you the right answer. Because we're going to look at the energy loss equations later. And they go like, I think, the charge squared and divided by the momentum squared. So you should be able to get to first order approximation. There are some log corrections. But the first order approximation is going to be something like one over the rigidity square. But again, it's the question of which rigidities you're actually generating for your quote-unquote relativistic particles, which are going to be much higher than the regular rigidities of cosmic rays. Like, if you have a very relativistic cosmic ray, it's going to be less affected by all these processes of energy loss. Well, I'm going to show you later the...
One more question. So if you have such high cross-section that interactions with cosmic rays matter, I want to go back to what Daniel asked before. When you have supernova and early star formation, why isn't all of this stuff ejected from the galaxy?
So the cross sections are A, not that big, as you will see, and B, that would be something that you should also see would happen like 10 billion years ago, right? These supernovae keep on happening, and they make you evacuate these particles. However, you have a huge bath of particles inside the halo, and they keep coming in with a max Boltzmann velocity. So as long as they can diffuse in time back into the disk, you're still going to get particles today inside the disk. Right? As long as the time it takes to diffuse from outside the magnetic box into the disk is shorter than whatever it is time you think these events, this galaxy looked very, very different compared to now, you should be fine.
Yeah, this is what I'm asking, because if it matters in cosmic rays, when you have a supernova event or the explosion of a star or whatever it is, the density of material, even if you have lower cross section, the density that you're dealing with are higher, matter. Injected matter is higher.
Then what? Sorry, I'm...
The density of the injected matter is higher than cosmic ray density. So why doesn't that alter the cosmology and structure of the galaxy?
But it does. We put that into our equation, the fact that you're going to lose them. Again, the question is whether things looked significantly different in the past, and that would propagate to this day. And the reason why I'm saying I don't think it would be important is because the question is, if you keep creating slow guys that come from the halo and propagate all the way to the Milky Way, to the galactic disk, okay, and they have a velocity distribution that is roughly Maxwell Boltzmann, because that's what we assume happens in the halo, because all these processes are obviously not going to be there, right? So as long as that happens, you're mostly affected by the recent past, quote unquote, the last few billions.
I'm confused, but perhaps we can talk about it later.
Okay.
Like this is a subcomponent, right? So it doesn't really
Yeah.
See the structure for me.
It's no, like, but is it trapped in galaxies? If you have, let's say, you have some first structure that forms, and you have a star that forms, star explodes. Why are these ejected out?
Yeah, they are ejected, but then they come back.
The amount of particles that get ejected, right? The Milky Way volume is much, the disk's volume is much smaller than the halo. So let's say you got rid of all of the particles inside the Milky Way initially, you're going to have more than enough.
Smaller structure, because the galaxy, how long does it take to get back?
That's a big part of the computation, and the answer is, for most of the parameter space, it's short enough for you to not care about the early universe. We have not, you know, that's what I'm saying. I don't have the full computation, but that's something that we did ask ourselves, especially because we don't actually know the initial conditions very well indeed. We thought about this just in terms of what happens during galaxy formation. What is the distribution of the Milicharge dark matter that ends up falling into the galactic disk? And we computed the diffusion time that it would take to come back, and it would take, conversely, to leave the Milky Way, okay, so that you go to the halo. And the answer was it seemed a lot shorter than the age of the galaxy. But there's some region of the parameter space where it's not necessarily so. And that region of the parameter space, you have a very simple solution for, which is just ignore it and say we're not going to compute in this regime. Because indeed, once you start to become strongly coupled to the matter formation, it becomes, you know, intractable to compute anything.
By the way, have you guys thought about cosmology early at all? By this fraction of 10 to the minus?
We have some lines for freezing stuff, right?
Yeah.
I think I removed them from the plots just so they don't overburden your eyes. But the answer is yes, but
yeah.
Not everywhere. You know, we look at a multi-dimensional parameter space, and we don't only focus on the freezing line. But you're right. In the end, obviously, the freezing line is a much more interesting target than anything else, because otherwise it is not clear why you would see the specific fraction that you're talking about in the early universe in this thing. I agree.
Okay.
And it is something that in the actual paper is going to appear. I just removed it from these plots. I can find one of the older plots where it's there. Sure. So if you didn't like cosmic rays, you're going to like this a lot less. But here we are also aware of this. So supernovae remnants is basically you have a shock front, okay, after the supernovae happened. I think this is called something sort of Taylor phase of the thing, but I might be confusing in the names, whatever. And it's some shock of the supernovae. And behind it, you have a downstream of shocked particles. And in front of it, you have just regular Maxwell-Boltzmann, right? They are affected by a bunch of things, but unaccelerated particles by the shock front. And what happens is you can have a particle that comes inside, and it would start to move with the shock, and then it gets reflected by magnetic inhomogeneities, and then it would get reflected back, and then it would go back to the downstream of particles that are less fast than the shock, and then it gets reflected by them, and you end up getting a lot of reflections. This is called Fermi acceleration, first order Fermi acceleration. And it happens for cosmic rays. We think this is one of the main sources of cosmic rays in the galaxy. And it can therefore also happen for Milicharge dark matter. There's like a paper of like 70, 80 papers that discusses whether this should or should not happen. And the answer is we don't know. And that's why we have an efficiency for this process that we take as a free parameter. Okay, so this process is expected to be very important, okay, because basically you can compute like Lamour radius, you can compute whether you should or shouldn't be reflected, and it looks like for a large part of the parameter space, you're going to see these particles going through a process very similar to the standard model. However, in the end, there's a lot of things we don't understand about this process also in the standard model. I think one big problem in astrophysics in general is called like the injection problem, which is about where are the particles that start this process and end up being accelerated come from. Okay, it doesn't look like when you run the simple simulations that people do for this, you actually end up with the right number of particles, you know, leaving this thing. But you can compute a spectrum under some simple assumptions, and then we just have an efficiency for this process, which just says I am a particle that was inside a supernova remnant. I have a probability that we call 1 over kappa to actually be accelerated by this thing. And you can choose to believe this happens, you can choose to believe it doesn't happen. That's why we also assume kappa can be infinity. But as long as kappa is not extremely large, as long as the efficiency is not very, very small, this process is extremely important. Because unlike all the cosmic rays, okay, that you know go like the charge squared, we don't actually expect to see such a huge suppression here. But we don't know how to compute it, which is why, again, we also look at the case where we assume these supernovae don't accelerate anything. So the supernova acceleration, supernova remnant, sorry, not supernova itself, the supernova remnant acceleration has this spectrum. If you assume that each particle goes through one supernova shock in its life, you can also try to think what happens if it comes out of one shock and then it goes into another shock and then it can go to another shock. But we find that process to be less likely. And again, there are uncertainties.
Sorry, what units does this quantity have?
No units. One over p. You integrate this to get one. This is like the spectrum, such that if you integrate from p minimum to p maximum, which is the minimal momentum that you're going to end up with this from this process, and the maximal one. So the minimal one is just your mass times the shockwave velocity. So here is a process that actually doesn't depend only on the rigidity, because it's actually just what is the velocity of this thing end up of the shock. And p max is just the maximal momentum where this process is efficient. And there's uncertainties on the spin max, a lot more than there are on the spin min. But again, this whole process is problematic because just like you could get reflected back and forth, in the end, you might just get trapped inside and never leave it. And then we would not actually see it.
Spectrum index is known because...
Is what, sorry?
The spectrum index. Like, why does it go like...
1 over p squared?
Yeah.
I tried to find a simple explanation. The answer is it's not a simple explanation. There is some conditions on the... velocity of the shock versus the velocity of the downstream particles. And when you end up plugging the numbers and you assume that you get, that you compute like the problem, I can give you an explanation why this is a power law, but the specific minus two is a lot more complicated.
So, kind of, is there uncertainties on that?
So, the answer is yes. We plan to play around with this parameter a bit, but in the end, I think the most important systematic uncertainty that we have that we model here is just the efficiency. Because in the end, the fact that, the spectrum is a bit more, you know, peaked lower energies or a bit more high is a lot less important than the fact that we don't know how this process, how efficient this process is, and it can give you a huge fraction of accelerated particles versus these processes might be, you know, inefficient completely.
Sorry, this is what I don't understand. Isn't the efficiency part of this?
No. This is normalized to one. This is, I tell you I accelerated a particle, now you can... dp times this is going to be the distribution of things. The next sentence, yeah, is that we assume that if you start out inside the...
Sorry.
Yeah.
Just to follow up on that question, like this index, I thought, depends on, like, the Mach number of the shock. Isn't that correct?
I know that the answer to that is that the word Mach number appears in the papers that discuss this computation, but again, it's an extremely complicated computation, and I will not try to convince you that I actually understand it completely. But my understanding is that yes, there is a dependence on the how fast the shock is and stuff like that.
So are you assuming that the Mach number is like going to infinity or something?
I don't remember. I don't think so. I think we assume that the Mach number is actually quite small. I think we assume it's some average. I think like because the Mach number is just how fast the thing is, right? I mean, in the can be yeah. So I don't think that's the assumption, but. I don't know to tell you for sure. I know that the specific number comes from something not called Runge-Kutta, because that's a different thing, but it's like a two-name condition. Rundito Iricchio, I don't remember the two names.
Rankine-Hugonio.
Yes, that condition gives you the minus two spectrum. If you assume that each particle gets accelerated by only one shock, you assume that particles can be accelerated by many shocks, it gives you a different number, but you know, we don't.
It's the limit of weak shots with like a low Mach number. You're saying that this minus two applies?
I don't want to commit to that, but I think so.
So, okay, good. So, besides like supernova remnant shocks, you know, there's also like virial shocks around halos. Normally, we only think of this as applying to the gas, but for your milli-charged dark matter, I guess then these virial shocks will then also accelerate dark matter particles. And every dark matter particle is passing through the virial shock. So then, I guess, are you saying then that the expectation is that the distribution function...
I'm not familiar with the term virial shock, so I don't know what it is. But from the way you're describing it, it sounds like, yeah, I would expect this to also enter the spectrum. And as we discussed during one of the lunches, also blazers and basically any also extragalactic sources in general. We don't actually model any extragalactic source here.
Sure.
But
the fraction of dark matter and particles being hit by a blazar might be small. Whereas here, like every single dark matter particle entering our halo has passed through a virial shock.
So I'd be happy to talk about this more because I'm just not familiar with this.
Is this from the cosmological infall?
Yeah.
As the galaxy first born, maybe?
Yeah.
No. I mean, like, even today, right? You know, so we have like the halo is like a multi-streaming region.
Yeah.
And outside is infall, which is like single stream. And the transition from the single stream infall to the multi-streaming, that's the virial shock.
I see.
But isn't it like there's like these four components?
No. So this cold flow thing you're talking about,
yeah.
I'm surprised that you've heard of this. With this cold flow thing, you know, I mean, you know, the idea there just is that the cooling time in this infalling gas can be so short that it stays cold all the way down.
Okay.
I'd be happy to talk about this more. What would be surprising to me is if it would generate like very relativistic particles, just because I don't exactly see how. Like here, there's some plasma instabilities that.
I wasn't talking about like generating.
Oh, but it could maybe affect the. Yeah, I don't know.
I'm interested in like, you know, what's the shape of your distribution function?
So the shape of the distribution function, we care more about hard cuts, as you will see, like whether there is actually anything slow that actually reaches a detector. And let's maybe move on, and you will see a lot of the slow guys are actually just going to disappear. But some of them do remain, and it is an important question. Like if you modify the velocity distribution by order two, yes, we want to know about this. I'm just not familiar with this process and what it would do. So, one obvious thing that we also need to ensure is that, you know, in the end, you also need to make sure that you didn't make these particles have more energy than the energy of the original supernovae. You cannot just create energy from nothing. So this efficiency has an upper bound. And it's not always one. In some cases, you cannot accelerate everything inside.
Wait, could you explain a bit more why it is difficult to estimate efficiency?
Why it's hard to estimate it? Because the process of the supernovae acceleration includes a bunch of different plasma kinds of waves. Okay, some of them have instability, some of them do not. The miniature dark matter can, in some cases, affect the actual formation of this thing and the conditions inside of it. If the charge is too high compared to the mass, there's some line I have in one of the final papers. And there's an important question of also the angles of the regular galactic magnetic field compared to the inhomogeneities, which make this a non-spherical calculation. Okay, so that enters another complication. And some different processes work better depending on your charge and the angle in some masses and some do not. So it's there are like dozens of different moving parts here. And in the end, it is not clear that they are, like, there are important problems also when people try to do this from a standard model and, you know, spend their life trying to do this. So we do not, you know, there's another group that tried to do this and they have a whole discussion about why maybe it is and maybe it isn't maybe it doesn't get accelerated, and why it might and might not get trapped inside a supernova remnant and in the end actually get cooled down at the end of the process. We don't know, okay, and we don't try to claim we know, and that's why we have this giant efficiency parameter instead of trying to make some assumptions that we cannot be certain of. So our new evolution equations are basically that we have our part, the previous thing, and now we also had something that makes you slow particles disappear from the galactic disk, and this is indeed what would, in theory, cause you to not have anything at all inside the disk, because this thing would make the slow particles keep on disappearing from the disk, and you need new particles to come in from all the way from your halo and diffuse back inside the disk. Okay, and of course, for fast particles, it's the opposite process where they keep on disappearing, appearing, but only inside the disk. So the things I didn't mention about this process are indeed the boundary condition, which I mentioned, but I didn't write it inside the equations here, which is just that you assume that there is always a flow of Maxwell-Boltzmann particles coming from the halo, and you just flow outside with your whatever your velocity is. And conversely, for the fast guys, there's no particles that are fast that are coming from the outside because we ignore extragalactic sources. And you assume that they just keep on living with whatever it is velocity that they have. They just flow outside. And maybe there are sources inside the halo that make particles that are faster than the escape velocity appear, and we haven't accounted for them. I don't know, again, the virial shock thing, what is the typical velocity there, but this is the boundary condition that we have. And the last thing that Curly asked about earlier is energy loss. So the slow particles, we basically ignore this. In theory, it should also be there, but then there are also thermalization processes that will make you basically reproduce some of the initial velocity. So if you just enter energy loss inside there, that's only looking at one side of the coin. Well, for the fast particles, we already accounted for anything that makes them appear, but particles traversing through the Milky Way are going to lose their energy via collisions with the ISM, and well, basically that's it, via collisions with the ISM. And this ends up being not very important for almost all the parameter space compared to other processes. But we do include this in our simulations, and we're going to discuss more energy loss in the next half of this talk.
Yeah, I know. Can I ask you, yeah. So what are you assuming that for?
So again, this is something that I think is an important continuation project for this, which is actually committing to a dark photon mass. Because right now, we're not really committing to anything. We just assume that it's light enough so that all of these different effects exist on one end, but we don't really care about things that are milli-charge interactions. Okay?
Well, I'm not talking about milli-charge interactions. Here, you're assuming that, first of all, there's going to be constraints. Then how light do they have to? So for a T, big dark matter particle, in a charge of 10 to the minus 6, how light does it have? It certainly has to be lighter than a GeV, but you can.
Yeah, much lighter than this in this calculation.
Okay, then if you have an MeV, for example, that for 10 to the minus 6, I would imagine there are other constraints there. What does that mean?
Again, the answer is we don't commit to a dark photon mass, and I agree with you. It's an important thing to actually do. And the reason why we don't do this is that once you choose a mass, some of these effects disappear. A lot of these effects, no one has ever computed for these masses. And we want to see what happens when you include all of them. And in the future, I think it's interesting to see what happens when you start to crank up the mass and some of them will disappear. I think one of the first to disappear would be the Earth's shielding, for example, because for that you need a dark photon mass that is smaller than 1 over the radius of the Earth. Yeah. But for now, that's just not part of this game, and I agree with you. It's an important question, which is why I think it's one of the most straightforward continuations for this. But the first question is just what do we expect, you know, the mid-charge dark matter to look like roughly? And right now, we don't really have anything, any kind of answer in general in the literature. Like the effect of the Earth's magnetic field, solar wind, whatever, these are things that people have not really accounted for with new data from Voyager and stuff, okay, or so that one is specific for the solar wind. So to even get a rough answer, the answer is we don't really have any good one. Okay? People assume that it comes with the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution to the atmosphere, and that almost never makes sense, unless you go to really small charges.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking also about entry. That if you have something that wants to come in the galaxy, all the interaction, how light or heavy this guy
is. I completely agree. And again, this will be in my summary slide, just the fact that I agree. As putting inside a dark photon mass and letting that change is, you know, the one of the most important, I think, ways to continue this thing. But right now, the answer is just we basically assume that it's light enough so we don't need to care about it. And no, we don't choose a specific mass. So.
Sorry, if you make it light enough, the problem is, though, that the epsilon, change on epsilon, that's the other thing. You won't be able to have, so you may have stringent constraints you can derive, much less work. You actually think of a proper level.
It's also like you can go to like.
Yeah, so for now we look at stuff that's very light because otherwise most, like a lot of these effects disappear. So I remember that there was some region of the parameter space for very light dark photon that we don't know that well right now. But maybe I mean.
16
EV,
there's no.
You
said?
TV? TV, I said. Up to a TV.
Up to TV. MeV to TV. Okay, though, yeah,
mean, the CMB is just because you don't get resonant conversion or something.
Yeah,
but this is not dark matter,
right?
Matter now.
Yeah.
If it was one of the constraints we now had in mind, is abilities on cluster scale, on Halo scales. Like
no, but this is not 100%.
Yeah. Eh?
This is not 100%.
Yeah, my understanding was that there was some parameter space that's still okay for the dark photon, but we don't even commit to a specific one, which is why I don't want to commit now. We're light enough, but again, we do assume that it's light enough so that all of these effects exist. But I agree with you. It is important to actually see what happens when you change it to more likely possibilities and see if you actually get better things, because in the end, we don't actually get what we originally wanted. Well, not originally. Originally, since 2020. Huh? Sorry? We wanted to explain the xenon one. We wanted to explain the xenon excess. We wanted to explain the xenon excess. That's what we wanted. When I joined, we wanted to explain the xenon excess by the fact that you kill the lower spectrum guys, and the problem was that the excess was centered around higher energies, and there was no low energy tail.
I see.
So if you kill the lower energies with all these effects, then maybe you can explain it. But we don't get. We probably don't get that.
I see.
Sorry, yeah. This is part of the preliminary guesstimate slide. So, Mealy charge dark matters, basically everything I told was just that they have a small effective charge, they can be a component of all of the dark matter, they diffuse through the GMS, they get accelerated by cosmic rays and supernovae remnant shocks, and they have a bunch of there are a bunch of parameters there that we play around with to model our uncertainties. But in the end, as we've discussed, there's always more uncertainties to add in astrophysics. So now let's discuss the solar wind. So solar wind, the solar system and around 100 AUs around it, has a stream of charged particles that the sun keeps emitting. And through magnetic fields, they can deflect cosmic rays. And this thing we approximate using something called the force field approximation. This force field approximation, it is tempting to think of it as an actual physical thing, but it's not. Okay, like there is no actual force field with an electric field that has this potential, but it is a very common approximation that people use, and it gives pretty good phenomenological fits to the actual data. And I have like 10 backup slides that actually compute and show that this approximation you can get in some spherical approximation. However, the solar wind is not actually spherical, which is why you need to add some dependence to this. Sorry, yeah, kinetic energy. That's pretty important.
Oh,
okay. My bad. You're right. So,
can you explain?
Yeah, that sounds pretty important to explain an equation when you show it. Usually, it's recommended. Yeah, so sorry, my bad. I forgot that not everyone is familiar with this equation because they haven't wrote this slide. So we have the number density of particles in the atmosphere, let's say, okay, around the, well, beyond the range of the Earth's magnetic field, so not the actual atmosphere, but let's say 10 times the Earth's radius, whatever, okay? And this we compute as a function of the number density of this part of the particles outside the solar system. And what you have is that these particles need to move through some effective electric field, okay? So they lose some of their energy proportional to the charge times this potential. This is some normalization factor that you end up getting from this calculation, because it is not a real electric field. That's why I emphasize electric field. It is computationally, it ends up being equivalent to an electric field. Okay. However, it comes from magnetic interactions with the streams of the solar wind. And it is not really even an electric field because it depends on properties of the particle. An actual electric field, obviously, is a property of space-time. But this is going to depend on the rigidity, on the velocity, okay, on the time. The solar wind has a 22 years period, and every 11 years, like the location of the Earth compared to some plane changes, and then it depends on also the sign of the charge. So positively charged and negatively charged particles, every 11 years, more of one of these can pass through. And this dependence has been phenomenologically fitted using data from Voyagers when it left, I think, in 2012. Capital T is the kinetic energy. This T is the time.
So this has a divergence. Like, if it can be that the kinetic energy, so Can phi be negative?
No, phi is always positive. Because this is the modeling of this thing. That's why there's an absolute value of this charge. This is just what you end up getting from the model. It's the integral over something like 1 over the diffusion, okay? But it's only the part of the diffusion that you assume is dependent on only the rigidity. And like, there's a bunch of ugly things that enter when you try to compute this phi. It's not an actual, that's why I'm emphasizing, it's not an actual electric field. It's always positive in this case. But it does explicitly depend, if you want to get a good fit, on the sign of the charge. Because again, whether or not your magnetic sheet of the solar system is causing particles to sort of get trapped inside of it is depending on the charge of the particle. Because these solar streams are moving around. And then if you're a charged particle, you might move with these streams. And then you actually never leave. And you might move the opposite way if your charge is opposite. And then you can go straight into the Earth. Well, not straight into, but more easily. So this ends up being, despite what people thought like in the 70s, maybe, and what you end up getting from this, not that important. Because indeed, depending on the sign, you get that for the most part, particles with the correct sign can get kind of unimpeded, or at least a lot less impeded than the particles of the opposite sign, again, depends on the rigidity. But the next effect is just going to be much more important. While this ends up, you know, maybe removing half your spectrum, but still, factor of 2, as you've seen, least of our worries. But it is an important effect that we account for using, you know, what currently people simulate this as. And for this, it's even harder to sort of estimate the uncertainties in this effect, because this is a specific model and a specific approximation. There are other approximations that people take, but this is what apparently is considered a state of the art in this thing. And we also have some understanding of it.
So for cosmic rays, like, this is also true, you know, you're saying that certain
sun yes. rays... Yes, so the reason why this is less important for cosmic rays is that cosmic rays, you don't really think of them as non-relativistic particles. And this problem of the charge dependence is a lot stronger when your velocity is non-relativistic, and you might actually get trapped inside these rotating streams. Because if your velocity is very relativistic, even if you move a bit to one side, in the end, you cannot get trapped in a stream that's much slower than you. But if your velocity is small, it does end up being important. Like the charge dependent part depends on 1 over the velocity, basically, like the contribution of that to the potential. So if your velocity is like 10 to the minus 3, that means it's really important. So for cosmic rays, you don't usually care about 10 to the minus 3 moving cosmic rays, right? But for these particles, we really do care about them. So even though they're, you know, their rigidity is as big as a cosmic ray, their velocity is actually much smaller, and that's why you would get this correction. So this is, again, a place where you cannot just rely on the rigidity.
So you're saying like the stream that hits Earth is actually charge-separated?
No, because as far as I know, like the stream that hits the Earth, is coming from the sun, right? Oh, yeah, no, I guess, yeah, so it must be charged for you. Otherwise, you wouldn't get a magnetic field, right? You would not get an average magnetic field if it has no charge preference.
Like the dark
matter. Oh, the cosmic rays, you mean?
Dark matter. Like
yes. Yeah, and I think that's also, so it's not just the Earth. No, this is also in the sun. So it is interesting to think if maybe, so in the end, this is like a position-dependent statement, but it could create a dipole for the dark electric field around the sun, which I have no idea if anyone can actually measure. Again, it depends really strongly on the mass of the dark photon. But yes, it definitely means that there are more particles of one kind of charge coming above the sun and more the other charge below it.
Also on the Earth.
Yes, also. So the Earth, every 11 years, crosses the magnetic sheet, and then it would flip the polarity of which particles more easily arrive here. So there's a 22-year period, and every 11 years it just switches sign for the Earth, because the Earth crosses this magneto sheet of the sun.
I see. Okay. So you're saying that this is happening due to the sun's dipolar field, which is then carried out by the solar wind.
Yes, but the question is whether this is like a sheet of stream particles, and the solar magnetic field is always in the same direction, but sometimes Earth is below and sometimes it's above this stream of magnetically charged particles, and then that changes the contribution of the magnetic field to the Earth, and sometimes it cancels, sometimes it anti-cancels compared to it, and for the upper polarity, anti-cancels for like the Let me. It's a 3D thing with a sheet in the middle that has arms, so that's why it's a bit confusing to try to phrase it. But this is what you end up getting, the fact that you have this sheet and it has a magnetic field that can be either more important for positive or negative charge, depending on whether the Earth is above or below this magnetic sheet. Because again, the magnetic field is always moving with this thing, but then when you're below it, the magnetic field contribution for you would be the opposite. So if your particle is coming from the outside, it would move with the stream, or it would move against the stream. And if it moves with the stream and it's very slow, it can get trapped in some sense inside the stream, or inside, just it takes a longer time to diffuse. And this, again, people talk about what is the best way to approximate this and what are all of the effects. This is the current best thing that fits the results. And one more thing to add to the pile of the systematic uncertainties. And the reason why we care less about this effect is that the Earth's magnetic field is actually more important. So to a pretty good approximation, this is something that you can simulate quite easily, right? If you assume the Earth has a magnetic dipole, then you can just simulate what happens to a charged particle that is coming with some rigidity. And what you end up finding is that your first guess would actually be a pretty good approximation of being correct. When your gyro radius at our Earth, because it's a magnetic field dependent statement, is equal to the radius of the Earth, okay, you're going to start to be affected by the Earth's magnetic field, okay? Because the gyro radius tells you how much you get deflected, and if your deflection scale is comparable to where you actually want to arrive, which is the Earth, okay, then things start to be important. If it's 10 times bigger than that, if it's 10 times bigger than that, and you only get deflected just a bit until you reach the Earth, and if it is 10 times smaller than that, you will never reach the Earth because you start to go around some circle that is much smaller than the Earth and you just get deflected completely. And this gives you a kind of hard cut between 5 to 50 gigavolts rigidity. Okay, again, the actual exact number would depend on what your angle is, because if you come from the poles, in theory, the magnetic field there is going to be more parallel to your velocity, so your gyro radius is going to be much bigger. However, because these detectors are not done in the North and South Poles, you would need to actually still cross some distance that is comparable to the Earth's radius, which you cannot do because the magnetic field there is not actually the same thing as on the pole. So you end up getting this result after a lot of simulations and playing around with the numbers, that there's a roughly hard cut when this thing is 10, the gyro radius is 10 times less than the radius of the Earth. It's very, very hard to reach some random point in Earth, even if you start out exactly aimed at the poles. And this starts being important around when these two are equal. So we model this as some weakly dependent suppression factor that at some point becomes just a hard cut. In the solar wind, if you're assuming that your charge is the correct one, so it's easier for you to come, you only get order one suppression if your rigidity is one gigavolt. Okay, so by that time, the Earth's magnetic field has already ruined everything. So that's why this effect is more important, even though the solar wind can remove half your particles fairly easily. But to ruin everything, you need the Earth's magnetic field.
We also like trap in the Earth.
I think people talk about that. We don't account for it. I think people talk about this, but I think they actually, they don't usually account for the Earth's magnetic, well, in one of the papers that do this, they don't actually account for the Earth's magnetic field, sorry. And that would be a pretty big important effect about whether they actually reach the center of the Earth. But in theory, yeah, it would be like a more complicated calculation about even particles that in theory should not be arriving at your detector. They go to the Earth and then they start accumulating inside the Earth until at some point one of them manages to escape. And in theory, yeah, that's a process that could happen. The what, sorry?
The poles.
So the problem is it is easier not to, I don't know if accumulating in the poles is the easiest place, but arriving to the poles is the easiest place because there the magnetic field is parallel to the direction of, you know, the R hat. So if you come from there, your velocity is going to be parallel to your magnetic field, and then the gyro radius in the end is actually only cares about your perpendicular parts. So it's a lot easier to come in from there, even if your charge is very high. But I think once you actually reach the Earth and you start to accumulate inside the core, I think it will just diffuse through regular interactions, and you're not going to care that much about where you came from. Okay. Huh? We have not calculated this at all. I agree. This is something that, again, people should do once they realize what is the actual distribution that comes to the Earth. And the Earth's magnetic field is something that I think people have not really accounted for, and it's very, very important for this thing. So this plot has these gray things are the bounds from some random places for FK 10 to the minus 3. And this line shows you roughly when your Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, if you came with a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, is going to completely disappear, okay, due to the Earth's shielding. Again, there's a factor of 10 dependency of what I decided exactly to put the hard cut here, which we plan to play around with, because again, we don't actually fully know what would be the hard cut here, the Earth's shield, the Earth's field. You might be able to move around it a bit and get diffused, whatever, around some imaginitis. But everything above this is gone. So the next part is kind of completely independent, and I'm completely out of time. So I don't know if you want me to talk about it or just jump to the end. Overburden, because you interact quite strongly with regular particles, you can get stopped by Earth's crust. Right? Xenon 1 ton has a mountain above it of 1.4 kilometers in half of the directions. Below it, it's bigger. And then overburden is just the fact that you need to move through all this mountain. But this is kind of a separate topic, so I think I can discuss it. I'm asking you.
Lose energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Show a plot. You can show a plot.
I have a plot. Yeah. I have a bunch of plots. I have one plot that actually summarizes the importance here.
Wow. How many talks you prepare?
No, because the first half of the talk was, you know, we talked about a lot of things that were not a part of this talk. So, this was supposed to be half the talk, roughly,
okay.
Or a quarter of it, whatever. This is the plot of the Earth's
maybe a little bit. So let's see, we can continue, but if people want to leave, do they have questions?
Okay, yeah.
We can continue.
So let me briefly just mention the way the Earth overburden works. The overburden, in the end, you need to move through the Earth. There's different kinds of interaction, specifically stuff like a Brehm that's radiative, stuff like elastic electron recoil, and ionization, not just elastic. And there's nuclear recoil, okay? And in the end, nuclear recoil is usually the most important, okay? All the other ones, they are important, but they're usually less. And what they do is they take a spectrum, and indeed, they smear it to lower energy. So even if you started out with nothing at lower energies, the overburden can generate stuff at lower energies. And this is partly why we don't think you could explain the xenon excess, because even if the Earth shield completely killed everything at lower energies, this would generate so much slower guys. This is, I think, the basic things here. But if you introduce a mass to the dark photon, then this overburden can be suppressed in some cases, and you might be able to actually still explain things, because it also kind of softens the lower end of the spectrum. So this is, I think, a quick summary of everything left, and then I assume some people here have things to do.
Yeah, that's fine.
Anyone online?
I don't know.
Matthias should be online, right?
He said that he wasn't. Actually, but I don't see the Zoom.
I cannot see. We usually see the Zoom. Yeah.
Somehow.
Oh, I think I never connected to the Zoom.
No, the room is.
Okay. Okay, the room is. Okay, because I never connected to Zoom, I suddenly realized.
Somebody?
Well, if they had questions, they would be calling.
Anyone here?
Maybe
we're not.
Okay.
The
room is.
Usually we see.
No,
because my laptop is not connected to Zoom, so you're not going to see anyone here. Do I have charge? I think I do. 1 second. Yeah, I have enough charge. Okay. So if anyone needs to leave.
There is Zoom, but people will have.
All right. Yeah, so if anyone needs to leave,
maybe we should jump to the plot anyways, because this is going to... Are you planning to go over the 20?
So I will do what you guys want me to do. I'm going to... If you want, I can go over the details of the overbed, and if you want, I can go over them fast. If you want, I can jump straight to the...
No, yeah. Then we can...
Let's go to the plot, and we can...
Great.
I don't think we'll have...
That's why I said I'm happy to do to end here, and I'm happy to jump to the plot.
Okay, good.
So this plot, okay, let me show you. I have a slide that explains this plot first. Yeah. So to understand the MQ plane, the one I'm going to show you, there are two kinds of counters here. The first is for electron vehicle. So electron vehicle dominates the higher energies. And the way we simulate it is if you start from a high energy and you slowly lose your energy, until at some point you reach the point where nuclear recoil dominates. Okay, so at lower energies, nuclear recoil completely dominates. And the first kind of counter, these are going to be the pastel colors, is just when you lose energy from initial Maxwell-Boltzmann velocity, from initial velocity to some Maxwell-Boltzmann velocity, which is roughly when the nuclear recoil starts to dominate. Okay, so this is going to be the pastel colors. The next thing we have is the nuclear recoil. Nuclear recoil plots are just me looking, starting with a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, running it through the simulation that we have for the nuclear recoil, and seeing when you roughly lose half your energy. Okay, it's completely done by eye. It is not an accurate line. It is just me estimating when the nuclear recoil makes you lose half of your initial velocity if you start from the point where it roughly dominates or the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So these are the plots that we have. You see that only if your charge is bigger than this tiny region that remains, okay, you're going to manage to move things from beta gamma, okay, from a very high velocity equals 10, all the way to the nuclear recoil. Okay, and it's slowly, and if your velocity is, 0.1, it's hard a bit to see the lines, but I think it's probably this one, then you can move within the Earth, specifically for the 1.4 kilometers of the xenon experiment, all the way to the point where you're dominated by nuclear recoil. And this is where nuclear recoil dominates. So the point is just that if you're very relativistic, there's a good chance you can arrive all the way from the atmosphere and to your detector and completely be unaffected. However, as long as you have some particles that are not extremely relativistic, some of them are going to actually be slowed down. Okay, and once they arrive at the nuclear recoil region, then they get completely distorted to very low energies. And as you can see, the nuclear recoil overburden can be more important than the Earth's shielding, okay, in the sense that you can lose order one of your dependence even after the Earth shield doesn't do anything at this point. Okay? It doesn't matter. This scales with the... Well, for this bounds plot, it's like 10 to the minus 3. But all these lines are completely unaffected by this.
You get the temperature.
The assumption is, so as long if your velocity is much higher than the dark matter velocity, then so it's just a matter of diffusion through the ground. It's not about like you, some of them just get scattered outside.
Oh, they just
Yeah. So so the electron recoil is just about slowing down. So it's not. It doesn't really stop until you reach the point of the velocity of the nuclear recoil. But for the nuclear recoil simulations, they are done by, you have a particle, it comes in, and then you continue forever until you either reach the other side or you get scattered upwards.
Let's say PV particle. What is the characteristic energy from?
So it is roughly velocity determined. Like roughly at 10 to the minus 3, the nuclear recoil starts to dominate always. However, at the lower energies, the electron recoil is actually not well modeled. Like if you look at the best current analytic estimations, they don't actually agree that well with data. But up to a factor of 2, they do appear to agree. So this hard cut of assuming, nuclear recoil suddenly dominates at 10 to the minus 3, we play around a bit with the number of when exactly we assume it dominates. But in the summary slide that we have, I think one of the first things that we can do is to integrate, at least to some extent, this electron recoil and the nuclear recoil to have it in one code. Right now, we're using someone else's very complicated nuclear recoil code. It's called Amescus Cross by Emken and Kovaris, I think, is the other guy name. So I know it's Timon, but the other guy, I think, is Chris Kovaris. And it is just for nuclear recoil, but something that is more reliable than just assuming, oh, there's always either nuclear recoil or electron recoil would be to add this into the simulations. I don't understand.
Be bound.
Oh, get like bounded inside of it?
Yeah.
Like trapped, you mean?
Yeah, bound. Like, I mean, if you have some material, you have an excess of charge because one electron
in
a bound state with material.
With ions, specifically.
Yeah,
okay. So we have not looked at anything like that of creating bound states with ions. My guess is that you will have a pretty big radius, right? Just because the radius goes like 1 over alpha squared, and now alpha has. Oh, right, sorry. Bohr radius is 1 over alpha, yeah. Yeah.
The mass is very heavy, that's why I'm saying.
Yeah, maybe you can. I don't know any problem with that. I think Maxim did the being trapped inside the Earth, no?
Eh?
I think Maxim did trapped inside the Earth, no? That I think was...
There was a long time ago where he was also interested.
Ah, okay, so I don't know.
For BBN. Like, I think like it's usually...
BBN, yeah, it depends. That's why I was asking about inside material, you mean?
Maybe. There's... This work is not meant to be the final word in this. It is meant to be, let's at least get something that we can actually not just say Maxwell-Boltzmann, okay, something that is slightly more advanced than that. But I agree, there's a bunch of different effects, a bunch of different things that one can add and make this more reliable and check what actually happens, right? But right now, this is just not done correctly at all, right? If people assume that Maxwell-Boltzmann comes in, they ignore, you know, a large number of effects here.
Question.
How this from
like the electron always has a state. So eventually, like this.
What?
If you have like an ion, like a mini charge particle bond state.
Yeah.
What's that? Like the electron wave function is S wave. So like it always has a charge which is inside. So like it will always. Any atom there is always an S wave.
Yes, there is an S wave,
but imagine
that.
See this. You are not bound to hydrogen.
Yeah, this is not the hydrogen is very special. So forget about that. Harvard,
yeah. For example.
Forget about BBN. I don't care about BBN. I care about what happens in material. Because there are searches, right, for middle charge particles. No. Right at the center of the Earth. And
you can also think, because this like solar thing changes every 11 years, in theory, if you trap one kind of charge more than the other every 11 years, the next 11 years, you're going to have an attractive force.
Oh, the Earth heats up every 11 years.
Yeah, so very good. So then, like, you know, volcanoes will then, you know, periodically.
It's much faster than the time.
Yeah. So to finish up, I think so. Yeah. So the first thing I would say is the easiest thing to do. It's still not easy, which is why we just haven't done this yet, would be instead of making a by-hand simulation of all of these different galactic magnetic fields effects, use the simulation that people actually use for cosmic ray propagation, and it would require modifications because, again, the spectrums are going to be different for the accelerated spectrum. You're going to need to add this cosmic ray acceleration, for the mini-charged dark matter. So there's a bunch of things you would need to add there, but it should still not be, I think, unbelievably hard. Next would be to add the electron recoil as one part of the whole simulations of the overburden. And the next thing would be, I think, right now there's bad modeling of the low energy part of the energy the low energy part of the energy loss plots. They are not well modeled, but I think at least that since you have like a much smaller charge than in the standard model particles, it might be easier to get here a rough analytic estimation. However, in the end, because you don't depend on loop corrections of the charge, however, I think still the atomic wave functions are a lot more complicated, so maybe this is not possible, which is why I put it third on this list. And the last thing is what you asked, which I think is the most complicated just because it has a whole dimension to everything here, and you would need to start to study these things in ways that astrophysicists never cared about, like what part of the solar wind is going to be affected by having a finite interaction length, because you're affected by both the actual magnetic field of the sun, which would not be there, as well as interactions with these streams. So starting to put the mass on the dark photon and actually committing to a specific model would be a nightmare, which is why I put it as like the hardest thing that I think, though, is important to actually add to this. And as we've discussed, once you know your spectrum roughly, there's an infinite number of additional effects you can integrate and add, and might be very important. And yeah, they would need to be added. So thank you very much for listening. Here I put an image of the solar wind I found online and of a supernova remnant.